who've put their questions on pieces of paper so that we can share their questions with everybody. There we go. Number one. The breath appears very smooth and pleasant, and the mind has no trouble following it for a long time. Then after 40 or 50 minutes, it gets monotonous and the mind is distractible. Or else I think, distractible. Also, I think it's the doer following the breath and not the knower. How do I know the difference between the doer and the knower? Regarding the first part, I think the monastery is me. The monotony is me expecting something more. Okay, it's very good. People usually answer their own questions. But it's true, when the breath is nice and smooth and pleasant, and the mind has no trouble following it because it's nice to know. Anything which is pleasant and desirable and light and delightful, of course it's very easy to keep your attention on it. But then what usually happens if it's happiness, sometimes even the best happiness, we get sort of discontent with it. But it doesn't matter, it was a long time and you stayed with a beautiful breath or with a very delightful breath. But usually what happens next is, the doer really does disappear, and you're just still with the beautiful breath. The usual course of events, it gets even more delightful, more pleasant. So the delight in the breath increases. And not only the delight in the breath increases, but your mindfulness increases as well. So you begin to see more of the breath. As I said this morning, you don't just see a breath going in and breath going out, you see all the parts of the breath, from the very beginning to the very end. You see all these spaces between the breaths. It just happens naturally because the mindfulness is increasing, the ability to see deeper and get more details, it becomes apparent. Very much the same way that first simile I gave on the first night, walking up the hill to the monastery, the slower you go, the more detail you see. And the more delightful it is. So as you sort of slow down, just with the breath, it gets even more interesting and more fun. So as we are meditating this way, you'll find what you should happen, it gets more enjoyable, not less enjoyable. Obviously, that the stillness in this question disappeared, and then you lost the joy and it became just monotonous rather than enjoyable. However, if it really works properly, then it gets more and more enjoyable as you go along. And as you go along, more and more interesting as well. So it's very hard to be monotonous when you see so much detail, so much interesting stuff there. You never realize the breath could be such an interesting thing to watch. It's similar to people who are doing the walking meditation. When you're doing the walking meditation, first of all, it's just walking left, walking right. But as you really get into it, the slower you go, the more the mindfulness increases, the more pleasant it all is, you see much more about what it means to walk. Every muscle, which has to be contracted or expanded to move the foot a tiny bit upwards or back or forward. I know that sometimes people have had strokes. They have to learn how to walk again. And what that actually means, have to start to understand how the muscles work. Because we've been walking for such a long time, we take it for granted, we don't pay any attention to all these muscles which are moving, we just walk. But as you become more mindful, as you get into these calmer, more still states of mind, you start to see more about what happens when you're walking. It's fascinating to see all these different muscles move, and just the way your foot moves this way and that way, in just one step. This is nature, you don't do this, it happens. The slower you go, the more still you are, the more delightful it appears, and the more you can pick up in what's happening. You pick up more detail. So after a while, it doesn't get monotonous, it gets the most incredible, amazing. You never thought that one step could be so much of interest there. So the usual way of things, it gets more interesting, not less interesting. The mindfulness increases and increases and increases. It's not monotonous at all, but it's fascinating. That's why I know that some kids used to say, what do you mean? Just you sit there just 1 hour? What do you watch? you just make your mind blank. You've got no idea what meditation can be. It becomes the most interesting, fascinating journey you can possibly go on. The slower you go, the more you see, and the more interesting it all becomes. So, if it was the fact that you lost the stillness, it had to be the doer, because the doer, the choice, the will, the controller, all the same thing, that probably got involved. And because it got involved, it just disturbed the stillness. So the process of getting more still, more delightful, more mindfulness sort of was curtailed. Doesn't matter. Now you've experienced that, the next time you get to those breath appears very smooth and pleasant state of mind, be careful next time. And find out what you're doing to disturb the whole process. Sometimes I say it's in those deeper states of meditation that you realize just what these attachments and cravings truly are. We all know, like the craving for food or the craving for sex or the craving for physical comfort, but these cravings which come up in these deep states of meditation, they're the powerful ones, they're the deep ones, those are the ones which keep you getting reborn. Those are deep cravings. And this is what you see, that your mind's becoming delightful, getting very happy. Why on earth can't we leave it alone and allow it to get even more delightful? Why do we always interfere with this natural process? And the answer is the three-letter word, ego. Because it's so hard for us just to leave things alone and let it happen. We always have to get involved. We always have to put in our six penny worth, as they used to say in the old days. It's very, very hard for someone just to leave things alone. I don't know how many people have looked at this meditation retreat center and already figured out how it could be better. Or designing your own new retreat center. I don't know how many people sitting in the back of the car saying, go to Serpentine, know a much better way. I don't know how many times people watch you when you're cooking and they say, don't do it this way, do it that way. So we always get involved with things. We just should leave it alone. And it's that involvement which gives us a sense of, you know, an ego, a self, I exist when I interfere with things. If I don't interfere with things, if I just disappear, then I don't exist. So sometimes it's what the Buddha called the craving to be, the craving to exist. So you mess up the process just to show that you're still there. So sometimes that's what it is. That's the doer. It always messes things up. So the difference between this doer and knower business, and I'll probably go into more detail about them during the rest of the retreat, the doer is what reacts to what you're experiencing. And the knower is just being aware, just receives the information. And the doer reacts to it. So the knower is absolutely passive, it just receives information, it's just consciousness, mindfulness. And the doer reacts, messes up, messes about, gets involved. Is that quite clear? Anyone, is that okay for that question? Anyone want to make a comment? Very good. You're just knowing, not doing. Well done. Dear Ajahn, in a second this afternoon, I have been alternating between tired and alert, tired and alert. Just as it be, sometimes almost slipping into a dream. Okay, tired and alert, tired and alert. You know what's going on? It wasn't really alert. What most people do with their tiredness and alertness, similar to what I did when I first was a monk in Thailand, I was always having trouble at 3 o'clock in the morning staying awake. And I really would try hard. I always had a lot of sloth and torpor in the first meditation. You usually start about 3:15 or 3:30 in slack monasteries, but usually in good monasteries 3:15. And it was really sloth and torpor that time in the morning. And I was really struggling. I was a devoted monk. I really wanted to live this lifestyle and get somewhere and do things. And so I'd really put forth heaps of effort. And sometimes you'd break through and you become alert. It wasn't really alert, it was restless. I was thinking all sorts of things. So I'd calm the mind down, calm the thinking mind down, and then I'd fall asleep again. And for years, it was always oscillating between the two extremes of being dull and dozy, or being restless. And I just could not find that beautiful middle when you were still but alert. It was either thinking, or I didn't know what was going on. And it was after many years, especially when I left Thailand and came here to Australia, I look back upon that time and think, my goodness, what do you expect, Ajahn Brah? I was living in this forest monastery in a climate I was not used to. It was hot and humid. We had no air con. We didn't even have fans in monasteries in those days. No electricity for the first few months. So, you know, it was a very hot and humid climate. And number two, you know, I was malnourished. I've told you all those stories of the disgusting things we used to eat. Basically, if it moved on the floor, on the ground, we ate it. You know, ant soup we've had before. Buffalo afterbirth. We did, yeah, that was great. It's gross stuff. And it, you know, it wasn't much nutrition in there at all, so you got very, very thin. And I was malnourished. So it was hot, I was malnourished, and I was trying to sort of, you know, do 4 hours of sleep at night and nothing during the day. You were sleep deprived. And if you ask any sort of doctor, then no wonder you were, you know, was dull and dozy with all those things going on. It was nothing to do with me, it was just causes and conditions, that's all. But you know what, I felt guilty about it. I felt there was something wrong with my meditation. Just like some of you, you feel you're a bit tired, and you're still sleepy after 2 or 3 days, and you beat yourself up thinking, oh, I'm a terrible meditator, I'm slacking. It's amazing just how we get into these guilt trips in the West, or in Singapore, or in Penang, where you've come from. Please don't feel guilty. It's just cause and effect, that's all. So if you're sleepy, go to bed. Makes a lot of sense for me. And then sleepiness disappears. So I, instead of just understanding the causes and effects and working with those causes and effects, I decided to fight my sloth and torpor, to do battle with it, to wage a war. And sometimes I would win. I'd get through the sloth and torpor, but it was an unwholesome thing to do. And that's why I got all this restlessness after my sloth and torpor. Calmed the restlessness down, I was back asleep again. And that was a pendulum. And I realized that that is not the way of a Buddhist monk. Now, if I have any sloth and torpor, I just leave it alone and let it be. I make peace with it. Because I realize now the reason the body is tired, been working too hard. And how do you expect to get the body rested when you do even more work by waging war with your body? Be kind to your body. And then your body heals and becomes healthy and energetic. Not when you're cruel to it. The same is even more so with your mind. The reason why sometimes in the morning or in the afternoon or the evening, I don't care what time, that you are dull is because there's hardly any energy left in your mind. Why do you waste what little energy you have fighting? So what I do, if I'm a bit dull, I leave it alone. I conserve the little energy I have. I make peace with it. I don't judge it. I don't get angry and upset about it. It's just nature, that's all. So I'm dull, I just leave it alone. Because I don't fight with it, because I allow it to be, because I open the door of my heart to my dull old mind, it doesn't last that long. Because I am not taking away the energy, but I'm being still, accepting, kind, the energy starts to trickle back into the mind. It trickles and trickles, and little by little the mind wakes up. But when I do get through the sloth and torpor that way, and it doesn't take that long, when I do break through it, gently, there's no thinking there, there's just beautiful stillness and peace. Because I've been overcoming the sloth and torpor with peace, not with war. So when the sloth and torpor is gone, I'm left with peace. And that's just the general way of dealing with any problem in the meditation. Don't make war and try and control and fix up the problem. Just watch. It's just nature, that's all. Leave it alone. Make peace, not war. Be still, be kind, be gentle. And of course, you're making good karma. And the result has to be positive results. Peaceful, wonderful, beautiful meditation. The Buddhists, you should understand and believe in the law of karma. It's one thing you can trust. So you can't make a good mental state in the future with bad karma now, with aggression, with violence, with guilt, with beating yourself up. That's bad meditation karma. So always make good meditation karma. Be kind, be gentle. Then stop and talk, but just when it comes, it's cause and effect, but it doesn't last that long. That's the way to deal with doziness. It's very easy, it's much more fun and far more effective. Using wisdom. Any questions on that? Very good. Dear Ajahn, I am confused. You've come to the right place to get more confused. No, to overcome confusion. I am confused by the different Buddhist traditions. Apart from keeping five precepts and following Noble Eightfold Path, how should one decide which tradition is suitable for him or her, especially which guru to choose and learn from? Thank you. I can't choose all, otherwise I'll be very busy, a busy tradition. Okay, so I think you've all heard this one before, about how, you know, because we live in a modern age, we want to sort of get the best out of each tradition. And so basically there were three main traditions, you know, the Theravada, they used to call it the Hinayana, the Mahayana, and the Vajrayana. So you know what I used to say? Take the H from Hinayana, the Aha from Mahayana, and the Yana from Vajrayana. What have you got left? Hahayana, yes. That's what I like the most, the Hahayana tradition. So make it fun and have some jokes every now and again. So, which guru to choose or learn from? Look, when the Buddha passed away, or rather just before the Buddha passed away, many people asked him, once you're gone, who will be the leader of Buddhism? Who will be, you know, the head of Buddhism? You know, who will be the great teacher once you're gone? There should be Ananda or Mahakasapa or Moggallana was dead, Sariputta was dead also. Who should take over when you're gone? And the famous reply of the Buddha, when I have gone, let the Dhamma and the Vinaya, the teachings and the precepts, let that be your teacher from now on. So what the Buddha said, your guru from the time from now on is not some monk or nun. So your guru, your teacher is the Dhamma and the precepts. That is your guru. Now that is quite an amazing statement. Because the Buddha said that, you know, it means we've got no sort of pope or archbishop who sort of tells everybody what to do. Which means that we have this amazing freedom in Buddhism to experiment, to investigate, and take responsibility ourselves. Even in the time the Buddha was alive, he said, Buddhas, we only point the way. You have to do the walking. So you can't just ask a guru, what should I do? The guru will only ever give advice. And in Buddhism, you are allowed and even encouraged at times to disagree with that advice and say, guru, that's stupid, I'm not going to do it. And that's actually encouraged. There was once Sariputta, the Buddha was talking and asked Venerable Sariputta, the wisest monk apart from the Buddha. And the Buddha said, what do you think about what I said? And Sariputta said, I don't believe it. And he says, the right-hand disciple, saying to his teacher, don't believe what you said. He said, marvellous, well done Sariputta, that's the sort of attitude. Now why don't you believe it? Because I haven't experienced it yet, so I don't know whether it's right or wrong. I'm not just going to go on faith. Because, you know, faith can sometimes be right, sometimes be wrong. Sometimes I misunderstood what you said. I haven't experienced it yet, therefore I can't take it on board yet. It's just a possibility. And the Buddha really praised that sort of attitude. So real Buddhism gurus, teachers, ajahns, they're just guides. They're not sort of slave drivers. They're not bosses. You should never follow a tradition where you have to abandon all your responsibility to a guru and just do everything they say. That is called a cult. That's nothing to do with Buddhism. And sometimes people say, well, shouldn't one just stay with one tradition or one teacher or one method of meditation? I know that some people say, if you do this meditation and that meditation and some other meditation, they said that's like, you know, digging a well here and then digging a well somewhere else, and you never actually dig the well deep enough. That's not the right metaphor. The right metaphor, if you're going to dig a well, you need a spade, you need a hoe, you need a bucket, you need many tools to dig a well. And you need many different meditation teachers and teachings. For those of you who have gone to university, no matter what subject, even if it was like chemistry, how many different lecturers did you have, you know, teaching you, say, chemistry? And why did you need so many different lecturers? Because everyone was an expert on different aspects of chemistry. And you needed sort of the different lecturers, and you put all that together and you've got a very good, deep and broad overview of the subject. It's the same with meditation as well. I have my strengths and my weaknesses, and so does every other monk, nun, layman, laywoman teacher. And so it's very good to go to many and learn the best from each and combine them. So you don't need even to stay within one tradition. If a very good teacher comes along, I don't care who they're, you know, what parts of Buddhism they're from. If they're a good teacher and they've got something to teach, fine, listen to them and learn from them. But if they come along and say, yeah, you should be a Mahayana Buddhist from now on, that's stupid. You don't have to be a Mahayana, Theravada, Hinayana, Mahayana, Vajrayana, or anything. Just be a Buddhist. That's enough. So when people try and sort of want you for their particular group or their particular temple or their particular sect, there's something very wrong there. As I've often said, real teachers, they want to get rid of disciples. They don't want to get more. That's why I always think I'm a very bad teacher. Because some of you have been coming to this retreat every year for I don't know how many years. So I can't be a good teacher at all. I haven't managed to get rid of you yet. Well, I'll try very hard. Because that's what I mean. A teacher, school or university, they want to get people to graduate, to learn so you don't need to come back again. So that's the right one to go on, is the one which tries to liberate you, not the one which tries to control you. So those are the best of the teachings. This particular age is interesting, because the last 5 or 10 years, just internationally, there has been parts of the Mahayana tradition, basically the Chinese, Taiwanese, Korean tradition, and the Theravada tradition, which have got so friendly, amazingly so, as we discover just how much we have in common and how we have this legitimate mutual respect. So the Theravadins and the Chinese, Singaporean, Taiwanese, Hong Kong, Mahayans are coming very close together, which is wonderful to see, as we now stay in each other's temples and share, you know, each other's teachings. The Vajrayana Tibetan Buddhists are still a little bit aloof. But the Mahayanas and Theravadins, they're really, really getting close together these days. I'm very inspired to see that. So, anyone got any comments or questions about that? The different types of traditions. Wow, you're really quiet. Okay, next question coming up. Ajahn, I think I have the same problem as the nun you used to speak about that didn't think she was worthy of deep states of bliss in meditation. This is quite a surprise to me because I thought I had good self-esteem. But down deep beyond my normal clarity of consciousness, there is lurking a lot of self-disgust. Any advice past the obvious of protecting loving kindness? How far this problem? answer? That's a wonderful question, because that is so true of many people who've been conditioned into thinking they're not good enough and have had so much criticism in their life. And it's amazing just to be mindful and listen to how people talk to each other, just to see how negative we are in ordinary daily life, and how praise is such a rare commodity, but criticism is just so common. Years ago, I remember going from one place to the other here in Perth. I had one of these multi-riders, so I was going on a bus. And I forget where, I think I was giving a talk at some school in the western suburbs of Perth and going back into town. And on that bus, I was sitting behind just some school children, and just all that half an hour, 40-minute journey, just listening to what they said and how they spoke to each other. And there's just almost every phrase was a put down, a criticism. Now, you're stupid, yeah, but you're ugly, yeah, you've got a big nose, yeah, you're hopeless. And whatever it was criticism after criticism after criticism. I remember in the school playgrounds when I was growing up, it would be the same. Now, the girls would pick on each other, the boys would pick on each other, and if you didn't do well at school, the teacher would pick on you as well. And when you get home, your parents will pick on you. And so sometimes I look at sort of how many kids grow up these days, and if you could take a tape recorder and just record what they heard in 24 hours in one day, and just count how many criticisms they receive and how many bits of praise they receive, I think you'd be stunned by just how many put downs they receive and have to endure in just 24 hours. When that goes on day after day, year after year, no wonder people have lack of self-esteem. That's where we're conditioned. And you know, in the religions of Christianity, where I started off, you were told you're a sinner, you're mean. It's nothing you did, it's I suppose it would be a Jewish girl, Eve, what she got up to. And because of that, you know, I'm not even a Jew. I was not born in Palestine or wherever Eden was, so why do I have to worry about this? But everyone is a miserable sinner. And when you look at that, I mean, that's just getting it worse. It's even more lack of self-esteem. And so if you come from a Christian background and you go to Western schools and just criticism after criticism after criticism, it's no wonder that people have lack of self-esteem. While they're running away from themselves because they're told that they're evil, they're bad, they're hopeless, they're stupid. And so it's wonderful to come across a path like Buddhism and say, there's nothing wrong with you. You've got this amazing, you've got a human birth. And that's amazing. You're the elite of, you know, the beings in samsara. So already, you know, you're building up. And out of those elites, you know, you are the ones who have, you know, chosen the Buddhist path. You're the creme de la creme. And of all those who've chosen the Buddhist path, you're the ones who've actually come on a retreat. You know, this weekend with me, you're the creme de la creme de la creme. Wow, it's amazing, just the quality which you have. It's amazing the amount of great calm you have. So when I say that, can you believe me or do you think it's a joke? I was being serious for once. I was! Come on! Why can't we accept that? Now, even this is an interesting story. I found myself sort of being self-deprecating when, as in 2004, I was given this award at the local university, John Curtin University. And it was supposed to be for, you know, community service, leadership and vision, you know, for moving the Buddhist society and other groups forward in Western Australia. So I went up to get this very prestigious award, and you're supposed to give a speech, and the speech which I gave was, you know, thanks to everybody, but, you know, basically I don't know why you gave this to me. I'm just doing my job as a monk, doing what everyone else does. And there's many more people more deserving of this award than I am. And that was basically the gist of my speech, but thank you very much. I didn't give it back, I did keep it. But then, because I got that award, I thought it's only right that I go to the next awards in 2005 to actually to support someone else. And the next awards were given for a couple of people. One of the people was Professor Joffe. He runs this Brown's Dairy Alternative Therapy Center in Charlie Gardner's Hospital. So any people who got cancer in the one of the main hospitals in Perth, they for free can go to the center and get Reiki, foot massage, back massage, meditation, yoga, anything, homeopathy, acupuncture, anything, Chinese medicine, anything which is a bit weird, you can get it there. Not mainstream medicine. And this professor, he was the head of hematology at Charlie Gardner's Hospital, dealing with many people with cancers, and he said, look, the treatment was, you know, top rate, but they weren't dealing just with their emotional needs. It was in, out, get the chemo, get the radiation therapy, and see you next week. And he wanted to do something more by giving people a bit of care and kindness, compassion. And so he said, he managed to use his authority and his influence to actually get a space in this big hospital and turn it into a place where volunteers and some professionals who got funding for this can give you a foot massage after you've had chemotherapy, just so that somebody was caring for you. And of course, you know, he's been following up the results of this, and it's huge improvements in people's recovery rates and health. It's very, very positive therapy, and he's proving it. And he got this award for this. And when I heard why he was being awarded this medal, which I got the year before, I thought, wow, now that guy really deserves it. What an amazing, wonderful thing he's done. And I was so inspired. But when he got up to receive his award, you know, he said, thank you to everybody, but I don't think I deserve it. There's many other people in this community who deserve it more than me. And I fell started thinking, that's what I said. And I thought, why do we do that? Why can't we actually, when we get an award, just say, thank you very much, I deserve that, and be honest? Because when I look at it, I probably did deserve it. I worked my butt off for the Buddhist Society. I have. And that guy, he certainly deserved it. Why is it in our culture we can't accept praise? Well, why is it we can always accept criticism? Yeah, I didn't get up early this morning, I admit it. Yeah, I know, I wrote that stupid cartoon on the interview room door. Yeah. It's very easy to actually accept faults, because that's what we're used to. And what's the result of that? Lack of self-esteem. We don't think we're worth anything. And wouldn't it be wonderful when people praise you? So, you know, thank you for someone who actually made me some mushy peas for lunch today. That was wonderful. Thank you so much. Whoever did that, no, it was nothing. It wasn't nothing. It was something. Well done. When you accept praise, it builds up the sense of self-worth, and you don't get into this stupid negative karma of thinking you're not worth anything. So more praise. Not just all your loving kindness, but praise yourself, value yourself. You're good enough, you're human. Human birth, you come to you're Buddhist, you're keeping the precepts, you're meditating, you are the creme de la creme. This really means it. You are elite. Wonderful, amazing good karma you have. So when you think like that, yeah, you do deserve the best of meditations. Another one person has to write that on their desk. I deserve to be happy. And they looked at it every day. I deserve to be happy. I deserve to be happy. I deserve to be happy. And so the message got in. So when happiness came, they kept it rather than throwing it away. So be careful, because sometimes that particular story, not the nuns here, she was visiting from overseas, spent the rains in my monastery down at Serpentine, started to get some loving meditation, limited on the edge of jhanas, and that's when she came and said, I just could not get in to the jhana. Why? Because I didn't think I deserved so much bliss. And I was crying. It still makes me feel so sad. Just so close, but this negative perception of thinking you don't deserve to be enlightened stops you. So whenever that happens, you deserve it, okay? Guaranteed by Ajahn Brahm. If you don't believe me, just look in the suttas, the Buddha. You deserve enlightenment. You deserve everything. You've worked hard enough to become a human being. So just being a human being is all the entry requirements you want, you need. So go for it. Well, yeah, I mean, that's probably the best way, is actually to just reprogram the mind with some positive reinforcement again and again and again and again. Because, you know, like coming to Buddhist centers, listen to talks, you know, like myself or Sister Wayama and the other monks, which is always positive reinforcing you. So I never criticize you or tell you off, even though that sometimes, Chris, but no. I don't do that, because that just doesn't work. So you give positive reinforcement, and people do feel they're valued, they're cared for, they're loved, and then they can sort of value and care and love themselves. That's when you see, when I see something worthwhile in another person, they see it in themselves. So my job, and your job, when you're looking at other people, look for their beautiful part. You can see it, they can see it. So that's one way. But there's another trick which is to be used, whether you deserve it or not. Sometimes it's so pleasurable, what the hell, I'm going for it. Even if I don't deserve it, who cares, I'm going for it. Because the other part of this path is just the sheer joy and bliss of it. Because the bliss, the happiness is very attractive. We like pleasure. And we move towards pleasure. And here we're moving towards an immense mental pleasure of bliss and jhanas. So sometimes, you know, she got a tiny bit closer to that, whether she felt she deserved it or not, what the hell, I'm going for it. Because it's just too attractive. So that's the other way of overcoming the fear, the feeling of lack of self-esteem. Just the sheer pleasure of it will draw you onwards. Never underestimate the power of happiness and how that happiness generated in this meditation retreat will drive you deeper into peace and further along the path. Misery just stops you in the tracks. Ajahn Brahm, halfway through yesterday's Dharma talk, I noticed that he used the word happiness a lot. Here we go. I did it again. And I continue to do so. I want to thank you for being such a wonderful teacher and for your contagious cheerfulness, which gladdens my heart. I'm sure it does others in this group. Thank you much, Metta. You see that that improves my self-esteem. There's a monk. I realise I'm not that bad a teacher after all. That's great. A little bit of praise like that that makes me happy, makes you happy. So yeah, happiness is important. Don't forget that. Okay, just to quote once more, for those people who think the monk should be serious and should never smile, please go and read the Dhamma Chaitya Sutta. It's in the Majjhima Nikaya, usually translated as Monuments to the Dhamma, where King Pasenadi went to visit the Buddha in the Jeta Grove Monastery just before the king was about to pass away. He passed away that night. When he went to visit the Buddha, he went into his hut, grabbed hold of the Buddha's feet and started covering them with kisses. Now, the Buddha was actually saying, this is a bit over the top, you know, you're a king, come on, you know, just behave more like a majesty. He said, what are you doing this for? You know, kissing my feet, you're a king. And he said, I just love you, Buddha. You know, you've been right next to, you know, my city, and, you know, you're my spiritual teacher, my guide, you know, just, I really love you. He's a very sort of, you know, a bit dull, King Pasenadi, but just a very ordinary sort of guy, and he's a very nice character, which really comes out when you read the suttas. And he said, I just enjoy seeing you and I enjoy coming to this monastery. And the Buddha asked him, why, great king, do you enjoy coming to the monastery, coming to the temple? And this is the answer which he gave, which I always remember, and it stands out and it's important to understand. He said, I enjoy coming to this monastery because when I come, all the monks are smiling and happy. And the Buddha said, yes, great king, that's what you would expect when they're meditating and getting some insights and successes in their meditation. The Buddha was actually saying, you can tell a person's depth in meditation, their depth of insight, by the smile on their face. And when that comes from the word of a Buddha, then that's powerful. You're supposed to be getting happier and happier and happier and happier. That's the path. So you're not supposed to be getting more and more miserable. I too thought that an arahat, an enlightened being, was some sort of vegetable. You know, just was sitting there. I actually heard a joke about that the other day. Two carrots walking down the road. One of them gets hit by a truck. Fortunately, the ambulance comes in time, and they take this injured carrot to hospital, and he goes into surgery, and the other carrot is worried sick about his friend, and the doctor comes out, so they've got some good news and bad news. The good news is your friend, the carrot, is going to make it, he's going to live. The bad news is going to be a vegetable. I thought it was funny. It's amazing how you get the giggles, you know, usually at night time during question time after a good day's meditation. It's a very happy time. Let's get serious again. I'm crying, I can't read the thing. What is the significance of keeping the 8 precepts during a retreat? Does this help improve the quality of your meditation? Thank you. Yeah, because, you know, if you go around sleeping with each other, that's not going to increase your meditation. So we keep the precept of celibacy, so you don't have to worry about, you know, all this sexuality business, of who's nice and who's not nice, and what does she think of me, and what does he think of me. So that's all gone. And so, you know, not eating in the evening, we don't have to worry about cooking and just all this cleaning up. I mean, how long did it take you to clean up after lunch? Do you want to do that this evening as well? So just get it all in one go or two goes with breakfast, and it's much more simple, so you have more time. But, you know, a lot of time people like to have a rest after lunch. Why is that? Because, you know, it makes you sleepy. In the evening your stomach is free, enough energy in your body, and so that you've got all this wonderful free energy where you don't feel so sleepy. So it's great, especially in the afternoon or evening, to have like an empty stomach and free just to feed. Like a class of devas who don't eat food, they eat joy. They're called pitibhaka deva. So this evening, you are pitibhaka devas. No food, but you're eating joy and happiness. That's enough to keep you going. So that means it's just for simplicity's sake. When it's simple, less things to do. It's like we don't have TVs or radios or sort of, you know, music. Now there's a piano in there. We don't go on the piano in the evening and just sort of have a nice sing-song. Because that's a distraction. We keep it simple. So that's the 8 precepts, are just to try and keep things simple so that we don't have too many distractions. Venerable Sir, how should meditators at this retreat fall asleep at night? Soundly. Should they lie down and bring their attention to any particular thing, such as the feeling of their back touching the bed, until they fall asleep, or should they not worry about where the mind wanders whilst trying to fall asleep? At this stage, keep it natural. So just lay down and enjoy a sleep. Because you've been working hard enough already, just sleep the normal way you fall asleep. And if you really are very mindful and alert, the mindfulness is natural, you just notice these things, you know, just ordinarily. You know, because you're very mindful, you start to notice yourself laying down and feeling the bed or the floor, no matter, it depends on where you sleep. And then you just allow yourself to drift off. Let go of the past, let go of the future. Keep the mind quiet, but don't think. Don't worry about what's going to happen next. And just one of the wonderful ways of falling asleep is just doing a little bit of body meditation. Just feeling the sensations in the body. Just purposely relaxing all of the muscles and the bones and the blood vessels in the body. And it's almost like doing a body scan just to relax everything. Because sometimes if, you know, you're very tired, sometimes because I'm traveling, sometimes you get jet lag, sometimes you miss your sleep, and sometimes you get so tired, and sometimes your body's aching when you lay down at night. I just do a quick body relaxation. When you relax all the muscles and the bones in the body, it's very easy to go to sleep. So if ever that you can't go to sleep at night, just do a little bit of body awareness, the awareness of the feelings and sensations in your body. And as you notice those sensations, just relax. And as they get relaxed, you soon fall asleep very deeply. But keep it natural, because sometimes when you do things differently, you control too much, you get involved too much, then sometimes you don't even get to sleep at all, and it becomes just too much more burden. So just keep it simple. Anyone want any questions about that? What is the peace born of letting go? Happiness is cessation of everything. Flame going out is ultimate happiness. Isn't happiness something? In other words, why isn't the end of suffering a coma or a vegetable like the carrot? What is it that happens to complete cessation per nibbana? Nibbana is, but not the person who enters it. If nibbana is cessation, what is meant there? Okay, you're going on to the B question. Enlightenment. Now that was a question which was asked by Udayan, one of the monks of the time of the Buddha, of the great monk Sariputta. He said, well, you know, if nibbana is the cessation and ending of everything, how could it be the highest happiness when there's nothing there to feel happiness? Now, why did the Buddha call it nibbana paramang sukhang, the ultimate happiness when there's nothing there? And Sariputta gave this amazing, wonderful explanation. He said, it's just like when you're sick. What does it feel like when you're ill? You've got a fever or so, got a flu or something. Now what does it feel like when that sickness disappears? That's happiness. It's the happiness born of a lot of suffering, disability, pain, aches, vanishing. He said, this is the happiness born of an affliction going. He said, it's the same when you start meditating, when you leave the past and the future. Why is the present moment delightful? It's only because an affliction of time has disappeared. When you get into, say, just watching the breath, why can it sometimes be delightful? It's because of affliction. That's the affliction of diversity of mind, having too many things to worry about and think about. That has disappeared. When you get into the first jhana, why is that incredible delight? Is because the affliction of the five senses has vanished. And that for the first jhana to the second jhana, why is the second jhana more delightful? Because the affliction of a wobbly mind has disappeared. You're absolutely still now. If you go through each one of these jhanas, a different affliction, a weight, a burden has disappeared. He said, just before you get to the complete cessation of everything, you've just got the mind, consciousness left. That too is an affliction. That's why the ending of that is called the ultimate happiness. He said you can call it happiness, because it's the ending of suffering. Now that was a very powerful teaching of one of the, what the Buddha said, the wisest person next to the Buddha, the Venerable Sariputta. Not only does it confirm that nibbana is the going out of a flame, but also says why that's the ultimate happiness. And it also tells you that really you don't know what happiness truly is yet until you get into deep meditation. That's why until you experience the deep meditations, you can't really get a handle of what suffering and what happiness truly are. That's why another saying in the suttas, the enlightened ones, what the enlightened ones say is suffering, the world says is happiness. What the enlightened ones say is happiness, the world think is suffering. If you go back home in a few days' time and say, how do you spend Easter? Just sitting on a hard floor meditating all day. eating two meals a day, no TV, no radio, no sex, no music. I thought, wow, that must have been suffering. So, no, I was actually very happy. What did you do? Oh, I went down south in the caravan. We came up on Thursday, seeing all these amazing queues on the road going down south. So that's a lot of suffering, having to haul that caravan all the way down south and haul it back and come. Oh, that's happiness. So, well, I say it's suffering, they say it's happiness. That's why when people go down south on a weekend, I go up north. So we pass them on the roads. They're in the big queues going south for the weekend, and I'm going north to Nolomara for the weekend. So it's much freer the way I go. So this is a problem. What people say is happiness, I say is suffering, and the Buddha says it's suffering. What many people think is suffering, just meditating, doing nothing, how can that be happiness? It sure is. When you disappear, how can that be happiness? Try it. The Buddha recommends it. The more you disappear, the happier you are. So it's maybe counterintuitive until you've had some experience. When you have some experience, that's one of the amazing, powerful teachings of the Buddha. To know that cessation is the cause of happiness. So it's a great question. Yeah. Go on. If anything is left, if anything is left, it's suffering is left. Now I'll ask you a question to see how many of you really understand the Dhamma. When you become enlightened as an arahat, do you suffer or are you just happy? Do enlightened ones suffer? Yeah, you've heard me say this before, but even some monks, they get sort of surprised. No, an arahat is happy. They're not. An arahat suffers. It's only when they stop being an arahat, at parinibbana, when their life ends, only then is suffering ended. That's why there's one amazing teaching in the Terigata, this amazing nun. In the Bhikkhuni Sanghita. It's an amazing bhikkhuni who was challenged by this guy Mara and saying, you know, you're not an enlightened, you're only a woman. Women can't get enlightened. He said, I'm enlightened. Who's enlightened then? Who are you? And he said, all I am is suffering arising and suffering passing away. That's me. Amazing. That's how an enlightened person experiences the world. Just dukkha arising and dukkha passing away. Otherwise known as life. But her difference was, at her last breath, suffering will pass away and never re-arise. Gone. Forever. Poor. Yes? Why should it be like that? Don't ask me, ask reality. So they ask you why. If you look deeper, it has to be like that. Sensory experience is always dualistic. You can't have happiness without suffering. You can't have black without white. You can't have day without night. You can't have cold without heat. It's that dualistic. So how can you have happiness without any suffering? That's always a problem. You go to imagine some heaven realm. Can you imagine the heaven realm where you get only the food you like and only the music you like, no aching bodies, no gut ache, only the people you like? You won't appreciate it after a while. That's why there are all those descriptions of heaven, you know, in whatever culture. Of all the descriptions of heaven, the one which I was amused the most with is the one about Valhalla, the Nordic heaven. That, if you know, that this is the Vikings, their heaven. You know, you only go to this place, you know, if you sort of, if you've been raped and pillaged and you died in the course of raping and pillaging, and then you're a good Viking, and you go to Valhalla, the hall of, you know, the King Val or whatever, and then it's always a big feast, you stuff yourself with so much food and lots of drink as well. You have lots of alcohol, and then after getting drunk and feasting, then you fight one another until you all die. And then you wake up, another feast, more drink, more fighting. So, according to the Vikings, fighting, drinking, and stuffing yourself. Those are the three greatest pleasures in life. It's interesting, they didn't have any girls in Valhalla. It was just eating, drinking, and fighting. And that was their heaven, which went on continually. You want to get me born in a place like that? I think that's stupid. But that's how they, and in the Quran, and I read there that their idea of heaven was like green fields with lots of water and lots of beautiful trees. And that reminded me of where I used to live in England. Around Cambridge, beautiful hills and pastures and trees. And when I looked at the Christian idea of heaven, it was beautiful sandy beaches and palm trees. That's where the Arabs lived. We didn't like the place where we live, but the place next door was always greener, and that's the idea of heaven which we had. And also, the idea of heaven in Christianity was harps. Do you want to listen to harp music for the rest of eternity? I don't know, I never used to when I was a kid. I much prefer sort of a good rock band. But if you had a good rock band, after a while you get bored of it like everything else. Because you do need change. Which is why I think it was the theologians of Christianity, they decided that the people who go to heaven, every year they get a day trip to hell. No matter how good you've been, just like in a tour bus, you don't actually feel it, you just see it through the windows. Just so that you can appreciate heaven. Because if you didn't go down to hell, you would never be able to experience the happiness of heaven. And I thought that was actually very wise. That's why there's only happiness has to come from suffering, and suffering from happiness. So if you had enough of that duality, then everything stops. Otherwise, you're always wanting happiness and finding it's never good enough. I better go through some more questions, otherwise we'll be up till too late. Thank you for your invaluable teachings. Ajahn, it seems to me that my faith in the Buddha carries my practice. Meditation isn't a major force. I've been meditating now for a short few years and still find that most of the effort is to stay with the breath. I cannot seem to get a handle on it. Calm and peace is there, but then I realise I'm not on the breath. I'm just there. No limiters, etc. Please help. As long as you're calm, as long as you're peaceful, that's good enough. What you're doing in this meditation retreat, whether you experience the breath or nimittas or jhanas, that's not important. What is important is you're generating calm, peace, gentleness, kindness, letting go. That's the goal, not to be able to watch the breath for an hour. Your goal is to generate as much calm, peace, joy, kindness, gentleness you possibly can. So that's your job. Generate calm, gentleness, kindness, peace. That's what you do. And if that's all you do, what a wonderful way of spending 9 days. And just developing kindness, gentleness, peace, acceptance, stillness, rest, being here. That's all you need to do. And then these other things, like breath, beautiful breath, nimittas and jhanas, they will come automatically once you're doing the right thing. If you go searching for nimittas or experiences in breath, you just get so frustrated. I don't know how many people come along and say, well, it sounds so simple, but I just can't do it. Because you're doing the wrong thing. Instead of trying to watch the breath, you should be developing kindness. So I said to many people during their interviews, what you're experiencing in meditation is not important. What is important is how you're experiencing it. How you're reacting to what you're experiencing. Whether it's a nimitta, sloth and torpor, or fantasies, how are you reacting to that? Are you acting with peace, with kindness? Or are you acting with fear, guilt, ill will, trying to get rid of this, denying it? That's the most important part of the meditation retreat. Making sure that you're not reacting to this moment with negative, unwholesome attitudes. And that means you know what you're supposed to be doing in meditation. Kindness, peace, letting be, gentleness, with whatever you experience throughout the next few days. Then you are laying the foundation for successful meditation. When you have peace, you have kindness and gentleness, there's nothing to agitate the mind. All these fantasies, thoughts and stuff, all this frustration just vanishes. Imagine what it's like if you weren't frustrated, no desires, just perfectly at peace, content and happy. How easy it is to meditate. So get the foundations correct, and then you understand just how to meditate. You're just developing the beautiful kindness, gentleness, peace. And that's more important than anything else. So I know that one monk pointed out to me, the way the Buddha taught meditation, meditation is for the one purpose of overcoming the five hindrances. And the five hindrances are the negative ways you relate to this moment. So overcome the negative ways and have positive ways you relate to this moment. Basically the job gets done. Is that quite clear? Because that's an important point. Whether you can watch the breath, you don't watch the breath, that's unimportant. That's how you're watching the breath, or how you are not watching the breath. As long as you're kind, peaceful, gentle, that's all you need to do. Everything else will come all by itself. Dear Ajahn Brahm, some Vipassana traditions teach that the continuity of practice is the secret of success. They teach that one must always be aware of the meditation object, bodily sensations. When one eats, drinks, walks, or even lies down, one must be aware of bodily sensation in that tradition. They teach that if one sits and meditates for 1 hour, then relaxes and loses mindfulness, sits down again and meditates a little later, and then again relaxes without mindfulness, there's no significant progress can be made in that tradition. Venerable Sir, does this tradition teach the same thing? The continued practice 24/7 is essential for success. The continuity of letting go, peace and gentleness, that's important. But you know, this continuity of controlling, that just makes you more stuffed up. So there's times when you are more peaceful, there's times when you are asleep, there's times when you are alert. But forcing the mind, this again makes you incredibly tense. And I've seen that happen, that people go on these retreats, and again, they're just so stuffed up afterwards. You can tell by the way they drive home, they're just soaking trying to get angry at people who cut into them. They're not relaxed at all. And I mentioned earlier, it was like the mindfulness, the Vipassana tradition, which that professor from Stanford took his students on for 1 day. And they found that people went to the spa were far more relaxed. You can't make yourself mindful. If you think you're trying to make yourself mindful, you're just forcing it, it's just control. It's not true mindfulness. It has to happen naturally. The more peaceful you are, the more naturally mindful you are. And that's actually the way to go. So it doesn't matter about the continuity of your mindfulness. It will come and go, of course, just like you know, the heat comes and goes, the pain comes and goes. What's most important is just the reaction you have to when things come and when they go. Samasankapa is the most important. And that's the secret of success. Usually, sometimes with the understanding, the insight, sometimes it's just like there's a wall and you're on this side of the wall and what you're supposed to find out is on the other side of the wall. You just need to keep jumping up and jumping up and jumping up. You only have to jump up once to get to see on the other side of the wall, to see what's over there. It's the same, just like one jhana is enough. You have to actually just see what we're talking about. So it's not the continuity of practice as much as these amazing events. These one-off events like a Buddha sitting under a Bodhi tree. You didn't have to sit under the Bodhi tree forever. Just the one, once, and get it deep enough, and then you're set. And so it's the moments of enlightenment, the discrete moments, not the continuity. It's learning how to, when everything, even on this retreat, there'll be some moments on this retreat, and you don't know why, until maybe later. Everything comes together, and it works. And you have a beautiful meditation. And just one deep, beautiful meditation, just in a whole 9 days, or several 9-day retreats, that's really all you need to do. That's really worth so much hard effort. Just that one breakthrough. So it's that singleness of breakthrough, that marvelous moment. That's what I teach meditation retreats for. Why I get so much fun when people actually have those experiences and they come and tell me afterwards. And that makes me so happy. I may not be able to do it again for a while. It doesn't matter. They've had a taste of freedom and understand what the Buddha was talking about. Any question about that? Yeah. Yeah, it's like the effort to let go. It's, and when I'm talking about the effort, I mean all the sacrifice, all the struggle. You do make effort trying to learn how to not make any effort, how to let go. The effort should be in generating the kindness. It's almost the effort to protect, not the effort to do things. It's the effort of a gardener who protects the tree, not the effort of someone who plants a tree. So the gardener just has to make sure that no one messes around with the tree. Because the tree will grow naturally all by itself. So your real effort is just to make sure you don't get involved. It's an effort to stop, not an effort to do things. So really it's not an effort at all. I'm not trying to be Zen and trying to be mystical. I'm just trying to sort of describe how, because our natural inclination is to do things, but sometimes it takes a sort of stopping effort to resist that tendency and leave things alone for a change. So that sometimes feels like an effort. Make sense? It's an effort just to sit down and do nothing. Sometimes, another simile, as I say, because I go travelling a lot, it's like the effort to get on the aircraft. You know, you have to get your bags, you have to go and check in, queue up, check in, go to the immigration, go to the customs, wait for the boarding call, and put your stuff up on the seat, up on above the seat. But when you're sitting down, you've got your seat belt on, you can relax then. That's all the effort you need. And now, sort of whether you go to sleep or whether you're completely mindful, that plane will get to the destination. Whether you're up in first class or economy class or back or the middle, you all get to the destination at the same time. If you rush to the front of the plane thinking you're going to get there first and put forth lots of effort, or you're just the lazy guys who just sleep at the back, you get to the destination at the same time. The signal of the plane means once you're on that plane, you don't need any effort anymore. The plane does the effort. And really, you're already on the aircraft. Just sit down and just enjoy. As I say, it's not the in-flight service. This is what they say. Sit down and enjoy the in-flight service. That's what it feels like. You're sitting there just doing absolutely nothing. And just, you know, those flight attendants come along and they say, "Do you want limiters, sir?" "Yeah, I'll take some of those, thank you." And they get the limited. And then another one comes a few minutes later. "Do you want jhana, sir? We've got first, second, third, fourth jhana on the menu." "Yeah, I'll have second, thank you very much." And then another one comes along. "Stream winning? Yeah, okay, I'll take some of that." Basically, that's what happens. When you least expect it, when you're not trying, that's when all these things happen. So try letting go. Try doing nothing, see what happens. "In half an hour's time, I will die. In this half hour, Ajahn, could you outlay the steps one by one on how to focus and prepare the mind for that final second of this life? Well, first of all, talk to me about your will."
big ghost.
Only half an hour you're going to die. The steps one would how to focus and prepare the mind for that final second of time. Okay, just formally just completely let go. Give yourself permission to die. Give everyone else permission just to do whatever they need to do. If you're going to die in half an hour, really let go. You're going to die. It's too late to go and write any wills. It's too late to go and ring up all your friends and relations and sort out all the problems. They'll sort it all out. If you do die, and sometimes people do die just like that, they just, you know, they just, what was it? Kathy was saying one of her friends went to Nana. They went to a lovely dinner. It was a school friend, same age as her. School friend, and after dinner they went back home, she was feeling a bit squeezy, went onto the toilet and died on the toilet. Just completely unexpected. That happens. And the world didn't end. Oh, it's a bit of problems of going to the hospital and the police and everything else, but it doesn't matter. It all sorts itself out. You are dispensable. The world won't end when you're gone. So just let other people worry about fixing up all of your stuff. Don't have to tidy your room up. Someone else will tidy your room up for you. Don't have to wash all your dishes. Someone else will do that for you. So when it's time to die, just completely let go and be totally irresponsible for a change. By being totally irresponsible, I mean you've done your responsibilities in this world. Let go of that and just be responsible to peace. Let go. Carry nothing. Let go of all your cravings and attachments, concerns. And just sit here or lay there, you know, if you're on a bed. Lay there and just make peace with everything. The body's about to disappear from you. It's going to go. So see if you can let go of the body before it dies. When it dies, you're going to have to let go of it. So let go of it beforehand. So don't worry about body, sight, sounds, smells, tastes and touches. Just completely let it go. Make so much deep peace, the body disappears. And get into a deep state of stillness. If you're still when you die, really still, then there's nothing to agitate for a future rebirth. People get reborn because the time of the death, they're still moving. They move into the next moment. It's called craving. But if you're really still, then there's nothing to give rise to rebirth. There's no agitation. That's why this still meditation is so important. If you can't still the mind now, do you think you'll be able to still the mind when you're dead? Or at the last moment? The mind will still be restless, still be moving. And you will create your next birth. You won't be free from samsara. Stilling of craving. The doing of nothing. The ability to completely let go is what's necessary if you want to end rebirth. So, you've got half an hour to go. So get your act together. That's what I would say. Ajahn Brahm, what is your advice on taking medicine? For example, if one has a headache, do you give kindness, gentleness, and let go of the headache, or take two Panadols? Can you get into a good meditation while on medication? Yeah, it depends on the type of whatever you've got. Sometimes you know that if you've got headaches, sometimes it's because you're dehydrated, so take lots of water, have a rest. So not usually the Panadols or the chemicals, you try and restrict those as much as possible because too many of them can't be good for your health. It's all just chemical stuff. But if you really need to, take it. So don't sort of make don't try and fight pain. There's usually very natural ways of overcoming stuff, the headache, and again, drinking lots of water is one of them, a bit of exercise is another, just taking a rest is another way. But if you need to take a Panadol or whatever, that's fine. If you've got diabetes, take your insulin. If you've got these other diseases, take them. If you've got arthritis, take the medication. So there's nothing wrong with the medication. So don't just that you can overcome all the physical aches and pains with kindness, gentleness and letting go. However, if the medication doesn't work, which sometimes that happens, letting go, kindness and gentleness, that can be very powerful. When you just let the body do what the body does. The body is sick, but the mind doesn't react. And can you get into a good meditation?